Good afternoon. This is Laura from Chorus Call. Welcome to Seafarers Shareholder Conference Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. Seafarer will begin today's call with a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. A link to the presentation is available at the Seafarer website, seafarerfunds.com, and also in the reminder email you received today with the conference call details. I will now turn the conference over to Andrew Foster, Chief Investment Officer at Seafarer. Andrew, please go ahead.
Thank you, Laura, and good afternoon to everyone on the call. Welcome to the firm's sixth shareholder call. We value these discussions as an opportunity to interact directly with both existing and prospective shareholders, so we do thank you for taking the time to join us today. On the call with me are three of my colleagues, Kate Jaquit, Paul Espinoza, and Daniel Duncan. And as Laura mentioned, the presentation for today's call is available on our website, seafarerfunds.com, and I do encourage you to go pick it up there because we will be referring to it throughout today's call. Our discussion will last about 1 hour today, and our formal presentation and remarks will encompass about 30 to 35 minutes of that discussion, at which point Daniel will take over the call to lead a question and answer session for the remainder of the time. If you would like to submit a question, and I encourage you to do so, please go to seafarerfunds.com where you will see a submit a question button on the homepage. I want everyone to know that we are, I think everyone knows we're based in the San Francisco area, but I imagine most people know that there's a substantial storm hitting us here today. So there is a real possibility that this call may be interrupted by a loss of power or phone service. And if that does happen and we're disconnected and we don't get to complete the call today, we do apologize in advance. If this does occur, we're going to try and complete a separate recording of the call and the presentation and post it on our website as soon as possible thereafter so that you can at least see the contents of our formal remarks. With these I should also say that Paul Espinoza is joining us from a remote location. He wasn't able to travel into the office today, so there may be some differences in audio quality on the call also. With these introductions out of the way, let's get started by turning to page one of the presentation where you'll see certain necessary regulatory disclosures. I'll let you read those at your own convenience, but I would also like to add and remind everyone that we will be discussing certain holdings of the fund on today's call, and while we are quite happy with these holdings as constituent members of the fund, we are not making recommendations for you or your personal portfolio because these holdings may not be suitable for you as an individual. Let's now turn on to page two where you'll see the agenda for today's call. We're going to start with a retrospective of the fund, which I will lead. We're going to look back over the last 6 months and really the period since inception of the fund, and also discuss some of the developments at Seafarer Capital Partners, the firm that manages the fund. Next, Daniel will take over the call and lead a discussion of the performance of the fund from its inception to the end of October. As the fund nears its three-year anniversary, we thought we'd go into a little bit greater depth on its performance to date. Third, Paul will come onto the call and lead a discussion about the portfolio construction of the fund and in particular talk about how the fund seeks to generate its dividend yield. And then after Paul finishes, Kate will come on to discuss two holdings that we've recently added to the fund, and she'll give you a little bit of background about why we like these names and how we found them to give a little bit greater sense of the research process and some of the holdings that were derived from it. And then finally, we'll finish with the aforementioned question and answer session, which Daniel will lead. I think there's a secondary agenda besides this formal one, and that's that I really want you to hear from some of my colleagues today. In the past five calls, I've done the majority of the speaking, and I'm really excited for my teammates to have some participation on the call so you can hear from them directly. And second, we are trying to curtail our remarks to just 30 to 35 minutes so that there's plenty of time for Q&A at the end. So as I mentioned earlier, please do submit a question if you have one. With that agenda out of the way, let's move on to page three, where we will look at the fund retrospective chart, as I call it, which is actually a picture of or a diagram of the fund's net asset value, or NAV, from its inception through Tuesday, December 9th. The sharp drop you see on the 9th on the far right-hand side of the chart is correspondent to the most recent distribution that the fund made of 28.2 cents. You'll see that a portion of the chart is depicted in darker blue, and that represents the last 6 months, the period since which we held our last shareholder call. And you'll notice that both in the last 6 months and really since December of 2012, there's been quite a bit of volatility in the NAV of the fund, and especially a lot of that NAV corresponds to the two periods at which the U.S. Federal Reserve prompted discussions of potentially higher interest rates, both May of 2013 and most recently in September of this year. And correspondent with those discussions of potentially higher interest rates, we've had a lot of currency volatility in the emerging markets, and that has driven a lot of the movements in the NAV and emerging markets more broadly that we've experienced as denominated in U.S. dollars. Interestingly, though, this most recent correction in the emerging market currencies did not necessarily fall across the quote-unquote fragile five. This was a moniker that was given to five different countries, namely Brazil, India, Indonesia, South Africa, and Turkey, starting around, I guess it was given to them by a sell-side analyst at Morgan Stanley last summer, and it really caught fire in December of last year. These five countries were deemed to have susceptible or weak currencies because of certain macroeconomic conditions. I thought that moniker was rather bogus and silly, and I tried to suggest as much on a couple of our prior calls. It was a very very cursory or not particularly well thought out analysis that led people to label these countries as being weak. Interestingly, since that time, one of those countries, Brazil, has continued to experience a great deal of currency weakness, but a lot of the currency weakness that we've seen in the last few months has actually emanated from Russia, which was never mentioned amongst those fragile five. I say this because I am one to be very cautious about emerging market currencies. I tend to think they are perpetually fragile. I just had some difficulties in believing that it was just a particular five that were more so than the rest. I think you've got to watch all of the emerging market currencies carefully at all times. I think I will return to the discussion of currencies a little later in the call in our Q&A section, but I would say that we are looking at this NAV chart with some frustration. If you were to add back the cumulative distributions since inception, we would add about $1.03 back to the NAV. So it would be roughly near its all-time highs in that regard, but you can see we haven't really made much progress since December of 2012 in absolute terms, and this is not lost on no one here, and we're quite frustrated with the situation. I would tell you that I don't think valuations in the emerging markets are the culprit. They were reasonable back in December of 2012, and they're even more reasonable today. The real culprit is anemic growth in the emerging world, and in particular, that anemic growth has encouraged the central banks of the emerging world to pursue more accommodative or relaxed monetary policies, effectively keeping interest rates relatively low. And this, in turn, has induced a lot of the currency volatility that I just discussed, especially because the U.S. is the sole central bank in the world, or major central bank, that's talking about raising rates. It's induced a lot of currency volatility relative to the dollar. As central banks have kept rates low, it has, undermined currencies a little bit and or a lot in the emerging world, and that has induced the kind of performance we've seen. I do think that the central banks of the emerging world are correct to follow this policy, even if, as it has begat some volatility in their currencies in their interim period. Amidst this volatility, we've been busy here at Seafarer Capital Partners, and I think most of our accomplishments we're quite proud of. One of the things I'm personally the most proud of is the continuing growth and expansion of our team and the depth of resources that we're bringing on board. On the call with me today is Kate Jaquet, who's been with the firm since its inception, but also we have Paul Espinoza, who joined us in May of this year, and you met him on our last call. We have also added another research analyst to the team, Samir Agarwal. And Daniel Duncan, who's on the call today, is a former colleague of mine from a former organization where we both once worked. And Daniel's joining us in the capacity as Vice President of Business Development and Client Services. And I'm very thrilled to be working with him again. Another key milestone that we surpassed in July of this year was that the fund, the Seafair Fund, eclipsed $100 million under management. And in September of this year, Seafair Capital Partners, the firm behind the fund, acted again to reduce the fund's expense ratio. What we did was put in place a contractual cap that reduced expenses on the institutional class from 1.20% to 1.05%, and on the investor class from 1.40% to 1.25%. The way these contractual caps work is they can only be made for a 12-month horizon, but we do have the intention to roll that obligation annually from here to the foreseeable future. In addition, at the same time, Seafair also acted to cut its own management fee, which is a subset of those total expenses that I just mentioned, from 0.85% to 0.75%. And for those of you less familiar with those expense ratios, our management fee is the biggest single part of the total expense, but there are other expenses due to administration, custody, and so forth that drive the differential there. This is the second expense cap reduction that Seafair has undertaken since the fund's inception. The first was in January 2013, and we're really pleased to do so. We think one of the ways we can exhibit leadership within the emerging market category is on expenses. We hope to be one of the most reasonably priced funds in our category in the future. And we're certainly not done with these efforts, although any additional improvements in expenses will only come with additional time and scale. With that overview of the last 6 months out of the way, I'd like to hand the call over to Daniel, who will discuss the performance of the fund in a bit greater detail. Daniel.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I feel very fortunate to have joined Seafair at this time. It's great to work with you again, Andrew, and I really feel honored to be considered a part of this very impressive team that you've assembled here at Seafair. After spending most of my last 7 years helping investors understand the opportunities associated for investing in Asia, I very much look forward to the opportunity of expanding that out and helping Seafair's clients understand how the firm is investing in opportunities amongst emerging markets globally. And I appreciate the opportunity to work with everybody on the line in that regard. I'm going to start out with talking about performance today. If you look at page 5 in the presentation slides provided, we have the performance for the funds, both share classes, and the index through the 30th of November 2014. On a cumulative basis, since the inception of the fund, which was February 15th, 2012, the investor share class has returned 23.45%, the institutional class 23.80%, and this is relative to the MSCI Emerging Markets Total Return Index of 3.08%. For the last 1 year time period, the performance has been more in line with the index, with the institutional share class returning 1.24% relative to 1.40% for the Emerging Market Index. And if you look at it on an average annualized basis, which I believe is how many investors look at performance, again, since inception, almost 3 years, it'll be 3 years in February 2015, you're looking at an average annualized for the institutional share class of 7.95% relative to the index of 1.09% for that time period. If you turn to page 6, you'll see standardized performance dated to September 30th, 2014, the last quarter end. This is for compliance purposes. Please do review these numbers as well. Moving to page 7, in my experience working with investors investing in emerging markets, the boom-bust cycles that are inherent in investing in these markets really begs the need to dig down and understand the numbers a little bit better, more than just the headline returns. And I think that's what we're going to do on this page here is provide a little bit of the insight of the kind of risk-adjusted returns you've seen from the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund, and maybe an idea of what you can expect to see going into the future. As shareholders of the fund, you probably recognize the objective of the strategy, which is to provide long-term capital appreciation with some current income from the securities, as well as a secondary objective of limiting the adverse effects of volatility while investing in emerging markets. This dual mandate makes the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund a core offering in our view, an offering that can offer that can provide exposure into emerging markets through full market cycles, hopefully dampening that volatility when markets are under a challenge, while offering upside exposure when things are going well. What you see in the chart here is really four different statistics shown for the fund, primarily relative to their peer group as defined by Morningstar. This is the Morningstar Diversified Emerging Markets peer group. You'll see that there are over 550 different funds within that peer group. The bar charts here are broken down into quartiles showing the rank of the fund versus the peer group universe in that quartile rankings. The first bar that you'll see on the left is alpha. Alpha is a measure of the effectiveness of the management of the portfolio. It measures the performance above the index at the level of risk that the portfolio is taking on. You'll see that the fund performed in the 7th percentile for the last 2 3/4 years. This means that it has done relatively well compared to the majority of the universe in that statistic. Similarly, in the second bar chart, you'll see beta. And the 88th percentile, which a lower number in beta is generally considered good, so the 88th percentile is where we would hope to be with the strategy, has shown that volatility has indeed been mitigated. You put these two things together, and it's not surprising that the fund has a high Sharpe ratio, which Sharpe ratio it measures the performance of a strategy relative to the total risk that it's taking on. It's not a benchmark-based risk statistic. It's taking in total risk and showing the amount of performance you get for the risk that you're taking. Ranking in the 6th percentile of the emerging markets peer group in Sharpe ratio demonstrates that there has been value offered relative to the risk on offer. Now, thinking again about the objective of the fund of offering exposure in emerging markets, the ability to appreciate, to access capital appreciation while limiting on the downside, it makes sense that upside and downside capture is something that we would look at, and those are the last two charts that you'll see here, the last two bars you'll see here. The first shows a 55th percentile ranking in upside capture, which means that with the 91% capture of the up months in the emerging markets, the fund, while the markets are doing well, is keeping up pretty well with the index. Much of the outperformance comes in the next bar, where you see a 58% downside capture of the fund relative to the emerging market index. And in essence, what this means is in the months when the index is struggling, the Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income Fund has been struggling less and protecting somewhat on the downside. Now, if you flip to page 8, you'll see what that looks like relative to the peer group on a risk-reward chart. In essence, what you see on the chart on page 8 is on the horizontal axis, you have standard deviation, which is the pure measure of volatility of returns of the fund. On the vertical axis, you have annualized returns. So these are the average annualized returns of the managers over that time period. Each one of these dots represents one of the funds within the emerging market peer group that we discussed as defined by Morningstar. You'll see the Seafarer Fund as the blue diamond that's above the horizontal line and to the left of the vertical line. And what this shows is that the fund has taken on less volatility than the index as a whole, but outperformed. And what that means is, as a core strategy, we hope to be able to provide a risk-return profile that's going to offer you the capital appreciation of the index, but do so with less volatility. Now, you will see that there are some dots there that are up and to the left, which is generally considered where you want to be, of the CFAIR fund. Right now, many of those funds that have performed well over the last three years are niche strategies, mostly investing in frontier markets and small caps. We believe, as the CFAIR fund being a core strategy, that we may not be the outperformer in any given market cycle. However, with the consistency of returns, we'll be able to build a profile that investors will be happy with through full market cycles. Now, understanding the performance of a fund is always important. However, really understanding the people, the philosophy, and the process that created that performance is really the most important. And in that, it's my pleasure to introduce Paul Espinosa, Senior Research Analyst, to dive into the management of the strategy.
Thank you, Daniel. I will dedicate this section of the presentation to examining the nature of the fund's dividend yield. By the end of my three slides, you will realize the fund's current income is not correlated to anything, and that this factor strengthens the portfolio. Please turn to page 10. The purpose of this first slide is to examine where CFAIR extracts excess yield versus the benchmark, the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. The white bars show the benchmark's dividend yield by sector, and the blue bars show CFAIR's growth and income portfolio yield for the same sectors. The first characteristic one should notice is that CFAIR extracts excess yield in all sectors, with the exception of energy, where the portfolio does not have any holdings. The second salient aspect is the unconventional nature of CFAIR's yield. The dashed circles highlight the sectors where the portfolio earns the most relative yield. As a testament to the bottoms-up stock selection process, CFAIR manages to find excess yield even in traditionally growth-oriented sectors with low payouts, such as consumer discretionary and healthcare. Such a diversified and unconventional source of yield means that a portfolio's current income should prove more stable in the face of uncertainty than the benchmark's own. Now that we have examined the nature of the fund's dividend yield, we will demonstrate that the excess yield over the benchmark is an outcome of CFAIR's stock selection process, not an input directing capital allocation. Please turn to page 11. The blue bars show the portfolio's excess dividend yield by sector and are linked to the left-hand vertical axis. The light blue dots, defined by the right-hand vertical axis, detail each sector's relative weight. Two ideas jump out of the page. One, the portfolio does not earn excess income simply by being overweight sectors with the highest relative yield. Indeed, sectors with the largest allocation tend to be in the middle of the excess yield ranking. Two, the growth and income product has significant sector weight deviations, demonstrating that it is not beholden to the benchmark. These relative weights are the result of the bottoms-up stock selection process. This explains why the fund has a zero weight in energy and an 11% overweight in healthcare. By way of example, the fund could have targeted a higher dividend yield by selecting oil-related names, which have enjoyed particularly attractive dividend yields recently. This would have been a case of selecting what superficially looked like the right names for the wrong reasons. Indeed, these stocks have collapsed with the oil price decline. I am not saying that CFAIR took a view on oil and made the right decision. What I am saying is that CFAIR does not put the cart before the horse. The fund first chooses the stocks it is interested in, and only then does it consider the impact on the portfolio's overall yield. In other words, neither sector selection nor relative weighting account for the portfolio's excess yield. This excess yield is the outcome of CFAIR's stock selection, not an input to guide capital allocation. This chart also explains why CFAIR has a very high active share score. Please turn to page 12 for a discussion of active share. The active share statistic measures a portfolio's deviation from passive management, where a score of 0 means a fund is a perfect replica of the chosen index, and a score of 1 demonstrates that a portfolio has 0 overlap with the benchmark. More specifically, this statistic adds up the difference in weight of every sector in the benchmark, of every stock in the benchmark versus the portfolio, and divides it by 2 to arrive at a score. CIFAR's active share is 95.8, demonstrating a high degree of independence in its stock selection and portfolio weighting. Please turn to page 14, where Kate will discuss two recent additions to the portfolio, demonstrating the research process and how it results in the yield characteristics just discussed.
Thank you, Paul. Moving on from the cross-section of the fund, we thought it would be interesting to highlight a few of the fund holdings which have some yield and discuss how they came to be in the portfolio. What I'm hoping to do in these next couple of slides is share some insights on how the research process works here at CIFAR by talking about two interesting additions to the portfolio which came out of a recent trip to mainland China in earlier this year. So on slide 15 now, moving on to slide 15 now, we believe that our fundamental bottom-up research process, we believe that our fundamental bottom-up research process on individual companies will both enhance portfolio performance and mitigate portfolio volatility over time. Our research process is dynamic and collaborative, and not only does the research team think it is important to look in interesting places for potential investments, we enjoy the process. As part of a trip to Western China in May of this year to check in on an existing portfolio holding, we wanted to see as many other companies as possible. As you may have heard us say before, we view the portfolio as a constantly evolving work product, and our best decisions tend to be upgrades on the margin. While we are happy with the fund's current 46 holdings, every day our research team is tasked with trying to improve upon the portfolio. So when we travel, we're always looking for interesting upgrade candidates. As many of you know, there are a great many number of listed stocks in China. So how do we winnow down this large number of stocks down to a list of 20 or 30 companies to see on an investment trip? The short answer to that question is we run a bunch of screens based on valuation criteria and on geography. In this case, we looked at companies in Western China with cheap balance sheets. While we are going to check in on an industrial holding, we tend to be sector agnostic when running screens, simply looking for well-run companies with compelling valuations. Several screens that we ran for this particular trip popped out a media company located in Chengdu called Xinhua Windshare. As we often do when we find a company that we're interested in, we step back and take a look at the sector in which the company operates in order to gain a better understanding of the landscape. What we have produced for you on this next slide is an example of this process, something we call a roadmap. And in this case, it is a roadmap of the Chinese media and consumer services sector. Please turn to slide 15. This sectoral roadmap of the Chinese media and consumer services sector produced a list of 96 companies located across China, as you can see in this table. Not surprisingly, most of these companies and most of the market capitalization in this sector are located in the Tier 1 cities of Shanghai and Beijing, along the eastern seaboard, and in the south-central corridor leading to Guangzhou. As an aside, when I say media, it is the traditional media sector that I refer to and does not include internet stocks. What I find interesting about this table is the scale of this sector, which has evolved outside Tier 1 cities. Fully $17 billion in market capitalization of media and consumer services companies are located in the north and southwestern part of the country, which is the bottom three rows on the table. And the growth rates across these companies are quite attractive, which you can see in the far right-hand column, bottom three rows. While we did not go specifically looking for names in the Chinese media and consumer services sector, our bottom-up research process enlightened us to this large and growing sector of the economy. Specifically, how much of the growth in the sector is outside the Tier 1 metro areas. This is a $200 billion sector of the Chinese economy trading at roughly 2x book value and generating close to $250 billion in annual combined revenues. My point with all these numbers is that this is a large sector of the Chinese economy which is growing at a healthy rate and a sector that most analysts overlook. With a better understanding of this sector, its valuation, and the main players, we then again focused our fundamental company-specific research process. I will now go on to talk about Xinhua Windshare and another Chinese media name that are some of our most recent additions to the portfolio. Moving on to page 16. Let me start off with Xinhua Windshare. Windshare is headquartered in the Sichuan province of Western China. They are a publisher and distributor of textbooks and other and cultural guides. The company also operates a chain of bookstores and offers other services such as online publications. The things that drew me to this stock are severalfold. First is the large cash balance, which you can see in this table. Second is a strong top-line growth rate for their online and supermarket businesses, which will hopefully further diversify the company's revenue streams. Thirdly, and importantly, the company has several assets which can be sold off, including a large stake in another publicly listed mainland company. Incidentally, the company has realized meaningful non-core gains over the past couple of years as it sells off non-core assets and focuses on its core business. What this tells me is that Xinhua Windshare is the classic case of a state-owned enterprise, or SOE, getting its act together. We also think the company's dominant market share, together with its state backing, portend a much larger capitalization over time. Valuation was the main driver at the time of the purchase. We put this into the portfolio in June of 2014, right after our trip, with a PE of 7.3 times and a dividend yield of 7.5%. Lastly, and as I was saying on the last slide, Windshare operates in an overlooked sector of the Chinese economy, and it is a sector that has healthy growth rates and, I think, many expansion opportunities. Moving on to Pico Far East, this is a company that's headquartered in Hong Kong. They design and organize exhibitions and conferences. The company also provides hall management services, museum interior fit-outs, and advertising services around the globe. Pico is the dominant player in this very fragmented industry. The company's investment merits include geographic and product diversity, a conservative management team, a strong balance sheet, and given their scale and breadth of product offerings, we think that Pico could be a consolidator in this industry globally. Pico generates 62% of their revenues from Greater China, with the balance coming from India, Dubai, Malaysia, and Singapore. And the company plans to diversify into other emerging markets, including the Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, and others. The company has no debt, so their strong balance sheet should enable them to weather years without big mega events like the Sochi Winter Olympics that they did a bunch of projects for this past year. Lastly, Pico is controlled by the founding family, and we are comfortable that this attractive payout ratios, with the company consistently paying out more than 50% of their net income, will continue. So dovetailing back on something I said earlier, the investment team here at Seafair is constantly looking for upgrades to the existing portfolio. As it turned out, both of these names qualified as an upgrade to an existing holding, so we made the switch and continue to be very happy with our exposure to this growing sector of the Chinese economy. And this is a sector of the Chinese economy that many analysts overlook, as I said earlier. It's an exciting sector that is growing well, and it's cheap by most metrics. In conclusion, what I've tried to convey here is that Seafair's investment process leads us to interesting places, and it is the turning over of stones in these interesting places that enable the research team to recommend upgrades to the portfolio. And in this sense, our bottom-up fundamental research process never ends. This concludes our formal presentation today. I will now turn the call back over to Daniel, who will lead the question and answer section.
Thank you very much, Kate. We have a good amount of time for Q&A here. So I would encourage everybody to send us questions that they have. Please feel free to go to our website, seafairfunds.com, where you'll see the Submit a Question link on the homepage. It's very prominent there. Please note that we may modify or compile some questions into one so we can get as many questions answered as possible. As we are collecting some of these questions, there are two commonly asked questions recently that Andrew Foster wanted to address.
Yeah. Andrew? Thanks, Daniel. I wanted to kick off the Q&A session with two things that we've been talking a lot about internally here and seeing some questions from clients about. One of what these things we're excited about and the other one not so much. If you can turn to page 19, you'll see what we're excited about, and that's the A-share market. The A-share market, for those of you unfamiliar, is a special market within China. China has many different facets to its listed equities. It has an A-share market, a B-share market, and an H-share market, and all these things mean that different market participants can own the shares. Foreigners have historically been relegated to owning either B-shares or H-shares, Hong Kong-listed shares, but not so the A-shares. The A-shares are denominated in China's domestic currency, the renminbi, and foreigners have not been able to buy A shares because to do so, you have to first buy the currency so that you can pay for the share, and it is generally illegal for foreigners to buy renminbi for investment purposes. They can do so for trade, but not for investment. There are some exceptions to that, and they continue to broaden all the time, but historically, the A-share market has been off limits for that reason. But something historic has happened. In April of this year, this index represents the top 300 companies listed in the A-share markets of China, both on the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges. So it's sort of broadly analogous to the S&P 500. It's the China 300. In any case, something rather remarkable has happened this year. In April, as you can see delineated on the chart, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange made a joint announcement with the Shanghai Stock Exchange about a new program called the Stock Connect, which allows foreign investors to buy certain Shanghai-listed A-share stocks via the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And this is quite revolutionary because, as I mentioned, for the longest time, A-shares were completely inaccessible. And then starting, I think around 2001, 2002, another program called the QFII program started, where only the world's largest institutional investors could qualify to buy A-shares on a very structured and restricted regime. But this new Stock Connect program portends a much more open future for the A-shares. What you can see is that the index has performed very strongly in recent months, and there's a lot of excitement sort of bubbling around A-shares at this moment, and I thought I'd talk about that. There are really three reasons behind the rise of this index in recent months, two of which are speculative in my view, and one of which is more fundamental and therefore possibly more warranted. The first reason for the speculation is the through train itself. You can see that the index didn't rise immediately upon the announcement of the through train, but it definitely did so before its anticipated launch date. It was scheduled to launch in late October, and you can see that the index began to pick up in late June, early July, in anticipation of new foreign capital from overseas moving into China to buy these A shares. And what you can see especially is that after an initial delay in the program, that when it was launched on November 17th, the market has been off on a rocket. I would see this sort of movement as being very speculative, but I think it is the program itself has been one of the causes. The second reason for the recent increase in A-shares has been, I think, a very worrisome speculation about the potential for more stimulus, I should say, in China via relaxed monetary conditions. What's happened is in recent months, reports on the Chinese economy have continued to indicate quite a bit of weakness, and that weakness has outpaced even some of the more bearish analysts' expectations. I don't think it's caught us off guard at CFAIR, but I think it's caught many off guard. And also, I think some have been caught off guard that the government hasn't done more already to stimulate the economy and offset this weakness. This weakness has prompted many to start to call openly for stimulus, and many sell-side analysts are suggesting that it's a foregone conclusion that the central bank will enact what's called a reserve rate cut, and to basically cut to the chase, that will allow banks within China to deploy more of their balance sheet that has heretofore been tied up for regulatory purposes, and that will increase liquidity and, perhaps offset the slow growth. I think this is entirely speculative because nothing has happened as yet. The government has not announced a reserve rate cut, to the best of my knowledge, and the market's movement on this is really an interesting case of the market moving on what is actually very bad news for China. I think it indicates not only slow growth in China, but what is really being missed in a lot of the analyses is how tight liquidity conditions are in China, despite the country being very solvent on paper. This was a fact that we tried to present to you on our last call, where we discussed the fact that much of industrial China is struggling with its cash flow. We presented a chart that shows that the days receivable on the balance sheets of the Chinese companies is rising. Days receivable means when you make a sale, you're in theory supposed to collect cash for having made a sale. But if you don't do so, if you give your customer credit to pay you later, you book what's called a receivable. And so basically these companies are booking more and more revenues that is not being offset by a cash inflow. And it means balance sheets are being more and more stretched as more and more people pay with what are effectively IOUs. And so this is an indication of liquidity conditions tightening in China. We also showed you how the residential development sector, many of the property developers in China have very leveraged balance sheets and have fairly substantial debt burdens overhanging them, and the only way to cure those debt burdens is to make aggressive sales in the property markets. And the data on the property markets is really quite soft. Prices are trending quite a bit lower quickly, and sales volumes are turning down, which is going to mean that the pressure on developers is higher. And again, liquidity is the core cause behind this. So really what we're seeing is this discussion of a reserve rate cut and stimulus is really more a situation of desperation than a positive stimulus, as might have been the case in times past. There is a third reason, though, this index is rising that I'm much more comfortable with because it's based on fundamentals, and I'm frankly a little bit excited about it. And it's the fact that, first of all, when this index hit its lows, and as you can see in April and May of this year, it was really quite low. Valuations had been falling for the five previous years as Chinese A-shares were locked into a really corrosive bear market. I don't know, I haven't actually even looked up the valuations at that immediate moment, but they were roughly 6 or 7 times earnings on much of the market, maybe a few stocks in the high single digits, and then a lot of stocks trading right around book value. So valuations were really quite reasonable at that juncture, if not attractive outright. And on top of that, I would say that China's government has been pursuing an aggressive economic reform agenda with which I'm quite impressed. If I were to rank the economies of the emerging world based on the extent to which they're pursuing meaningful economic reform that will spur higher growth in the future, I would rank China first on that list. I'm not saying that China will necessarily implement all the announced reforms or do so successfully, but if they follow through on half of what they're talking about, China does look like it will have a stronger economy in the future. And so I think there's a chance that though China's growth is continuing to decelerate, a better future does lie ahead 3 to 4 years out. And I think the market is to some extent rallying based on low valuations and the prospect that the economy might eventually heal itself. So as I say, this rally is 2/3 speculative, 1/3 fundamental. I would not, as some are, classify it as an outright bubble. Markets often find bottoms for reasons that at the time seem mysterious. But which later are verified by data. I would suggest to everyone on this call to continue to watch the story unfold in China and watch what happens with this A-share market, because the event of its opening is an historic occasion and speaks strongly of the growing maturity and depth of this market, and it's important for all global investors to pay attention to. Unfortunately, though, I have some somewhat challenging news at this moment. The fund itself is not able yet to participate in the Stock Connect program, even though we would like to do so. There are certain technicalities associated with trading and particularly settlement of securities via the Stock Connect program that pose unique challenges for 1940 Act mutual funds as opposed to other investment vehicles. Hedge funds, not so much affected. Other kinds of products, not so much affected. But mutual funds face unique challenges. And those challenges are ones that we have not been able to overcome as yet. So we are not investing via this program. However, we have sharpened our pencils. We are already doing research on A-share companies, and we even have a few we would consider purchasing were the market open to us today. So this is something we're actively working on, and as soon as we can resolve it, we will. You'll find out from us in future portfolio review commentaries as and when we're able to make use of the Connect program. I don't, by the way, think it will be a very large part of the fund ever, but there is certain risk disclosure on this market in the prospectus already in advance of the potential for investing in this market, but I would imagine that it could become 5 to 10% of the fund's net assets over time. Moving to the second item I want to discuss on page 20, this is the item that we're not excited about, which is emerging market currencies, as I alluded to earlier in the call, and you can see they have been weak. This chart represents a basket of emerging market currencies that is assembled by Bloomberg on a proprietary basis, measured against the U.S. dollar from the inception of our fund until the end of, or really just a few days ago, December 5th. And you can see the pronounced weakness. In fact, this basket of currencies has fallen 17% versus the dollar, and its decline has accelerated in recent months, especially led by the Russian ruble. You can see this again in a different way on page 21, where you'll see the two lines that represent two different indices that are nearly identical but for one key fact. One is denominated in dollars, and the other is denominated in local currency terms. These are both the MSCI Emerging Market Total Return Index with gross dividends reinvested, but the dark blue line represents the U.S. dollar-denominated index, which is, by the way, the fund's prospectus benchmark, which is basically flat since inception through the 5th, and a little above flat since inception. It gained 1.1% cumulatively. And the light blue line represents the index, sort of an imaginary index that has been calculated on a basis whereby the effect of the dollar's movement against the underlying currencies is neutralized each and every day. So it's a hypothetical index. I guess you could say if you had hedged the currency perfectly, the underlying currencies perfectly over the last two and three quarters years, you would have had a 17.8% gain in the underlying stocks. It's a pretty hypothetical index, but it tries to strip away the currency effect of the dollar. So what you see here is a lot of the depressed returns in the emerging world are arising from currency action, not necessarily so much stock action, although the stocks gains themselves have not been terribly strong. And I want to suggest to you here, and there's a 17% differential, which is not coincidentally, it is not a coincidence that that's about the same margin that I showed you on the prior slide with the proprietary Bloomberg Index. But I want to suggest to you we're at an interesting juncture in the world's global financial markets at this moment. My comments here are just purely my own beliefs, not necessarily rooted in fact as yet. But I will tell you that 4 years ago when I started Seafarer, one of the things that was most easily able for me, I was most easily able to determine both factually and qualitatively was the overwhelming weakness of the dollar and investors' desire to flee it. People had, poorly based perception that the dollar would be weakening and weakening further, and there was a desire to flee just about anything dollar-denominated for anything that might prove to be a safe haven. On the list was oil, gold, other hard metals, emerging market local fixed income, locally denominated fixed income bonds, just about anything that would take one out of a dollar-denominated world. I was clear, Seafarer was clear to suggest that at least as far as emerging market currencies were concerned, that this bias against the dollar was misplaced, that the dollar would, not so much that the dollar would be strong, but the belief that emerging market currencies would eclipse the dollar, I thought was both overstated and as far as we could prove it factually, it wasn't true. Here we are almost 4 years later from that time, and I think the pendulum has begun to swing very far in the opposite direction. Maybe not far enough yet, but I want to suggest to you that when we sit here in the United States and our world is denominated in dollars, when we see the price of assets fall as denominated in dollars, it tends to suggest to us that everything looks weak. The demand for those items looks weak, and therefore they are falling. I want to suggest at least throw out an alternative hypothesis, which is that the demand for the dollar has become excessively strong, and therefore anything denominated in it, the price of it will fall. In other words, there's more demand for dollars than everything else in the world right now. And I'm more comfortable to say it because it's not just emerging market currencies that are falling, but just about everything on the radar screen. European assets, oil, gold, certainly those emerging market fixed income bonds, everything is falling as denominated in the dollar. So I think one has to be careful that our perception of the world, which is so U.S.-centric, doesn't lead us astray from the possibility that the dollar is maybe beginning to become untowardly strong. So it's just something to consider as you look at your asset allocation. It's certainly been a headwind for us, and we're not fond of it, but it's a reality that is, I think, a mere reflection of where the dollar was a few years ago.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you, everybody, online for submitting questions. We have a number of questions to go through, so let's go ahead and start with a few that have been asked about the regional makeup of the portfolio, and the questions have revolved around your view of investing in Latin America, specifically Brazil, and maybe your bias towards the markets of Asia from your background.
I don't believe I'm biased towards the markets of Asia. You know, I suppose in a very general sense, I'm very comfortable there. I've been working there for a long time. The fund is about 60%. It's been averaging roughly 60% invested in Asia-Pacific, broadly drawn, since its inception. In the very earliest days around its launch, that number was more like 85%, but it's really come down since that time. Part of the reason it was tilted toward Asia is because we do some crude currency risk management here, and that crude risk management kept us out of Latin America until much more recently, particularly Brazil. But recently, with the Brazilian real's collapse, it's actually looking more attractive to us, and therefore the weighting of Brazil has risen. It's been rising, really predicated on the underlying merits of the individual stocks we're adding to the portfolio, but the crude risk management that we do has made it more approachable to pick up assets denominated in real. The real continues to be weak. In fact, on some occasions, shockingly weak. I think from an economic perspective, I think some of this is beginning to look like overshoot, as I alluded to a moment ago. But we're quite comfortable to be investing in Brazil. I have generally been one to reject the hypothesis that the Rousseff government has been awful for Brazil. I don't think it's been great for Brazil, and it's caused a number of problems. But I think what really has hit Brazil is the slowdown in China, and that there's been a deceleration in demand for a lot of the commodities that it produces, and a lot of the those commodities that fueled the demand for the real. So I think we don't really invest in those sectors very extensively. We do have a position in Vale right now, but otherwise we've generally invested outside of those commodity-intensive sectors, and we think there are good valuations on offer in a currency that's increasingly looking attractive at a margin. So we're excited to be investing there.
And this is Kate. I would just add that, you know, I mean, I would agree with everything Andrew just said. While the macro indicators in Brazil are not exactly exciting right now, there are still quite a few good companies there, and we're focused on finding these companies not only in Brazil but around the globe. And it's our fundamental bottom-up research process that's allowed us to identify some really neat companies in Brazil, one of which is a company called Valid, which produces bank cards, check printing, driver's license, passports, and identification services. Their core driver's license business is doing very well. Providing driver's license to roughly 15 states in Brazil, and they are expanding elsewhere, notably into the United States.
Very good. Thank you very much, Kate. That's fantastic. Andrew, you've recently written about the rise in the opportunity of investing in more value-oriented companies. Could you talk a little bit more about that, specifically in the context of the current fund, but also the market opportunity and what's happening there for value investors in emerging markets?
Yeah, I've got to step back and give just a brief bit of context. I was trained under a philosophy that suggested value was tantamount to a value trap, in at least as applied to the emerging world. What I mean by that, let me first define value. Value, in my definition, is buying a stock cheaply, but especially deriving that cheapness from the balance sheet of the company and the discount to which you can buy the stock relative to the book value versus buying a position that might be cheap relative to its future growth potential as derived from the income statement. So what I'm saying is value-driven investments that were balance sheet orientated were considered a value trap in my in the philosophy in which I was trained. And the reason for this is because the emerging world had a number of impediments that meant that passive foreign minority investors, that is to say folks that were overseas and foreigners and were not taking control-style investments, would generally be unable to realize investments, or excuse me, realize the value that might be trapped within a balance sheet because the scales were tilted against them. Laws, regulations, and frankly cultures generally meant that a foreign investor agitating for value to be released from a balance sheet meant that it would fall on deaf ears, and there were not enough protections to ensure that minorities would be hurt while holding the stock waiting for the value to be unlocked. But that was really a sign of the rudimentary development of the emerging world 15, 20 years ago when that philosophy was put into place. Today, quite a bit has changed, and I think I would say that the change is beginning to gather momentum to the extent that I'm comfortable that the laws and regulations of the emerging world are making it at least somewhat more friendly for a value orientation to gain a foothold. In particular, some of the more developed of the emerging world, and I would especially point to China and Korea as examples of markets where the regulatory landscape, the legal landscape, is becoming more friendly to foreign passive minority shareholders such that value on balance sheets might be unlocked. And therefore, I'm becoming increasingly comfortable with a strategy that focuses on balance sheet value as opposed to one that tries to aim for growth in the income statement that is manifest in a dividend. That latter strategy is what fuels the growth and income strategy today, and it will remain the main fuel of the strategy from here for the foreseeable future. But what I would say is that I am increasingly looking for investments that exhibit even more balance sheet value alongside their growth and income capacity, because I think that that balance sheet value will be rewarded to long-term shareholders without the possibility that will be hurt by value traps as much as we might have been in the past. There's still many risks with a deep value investment, but I think we're going to try and mine this segment of the market a bit more at the margin, and we've had some success to date with that in mind. So no change to the strategy, just more of a tilt at the margin.
Very good. Thank you very much, Andrew. And we are approaching the hour mark for our call today, and we want to be respectful of everybody's time that has joined us. So I believe we're going to ask one more question before we wrap up the call. You discussed earlier how one of the contributing factors to the softness in commodity prices is slowing growth in China. On the flip side of that, are you concerned that China cutting interest rates will exacerbate their debt and overcapacity challenges that they've had in the past?
I think China, let's start with some facts. China cut interest rates recently. The central bank did. Interest rates did not fall in the marketplace in line with that. That, I think, is a story of the tight liquidity that exists in the economy today, that even as the central bank has tried to reduce rates, rates haven't fallen. What has been discussed is cutting the reserve rate, reserve requirement, which will basically free up liquidity that is otherwise trapped on certain bank balance sheets, but it could lead to the same outcome where more loans are made and more with those loans more investment is made in some sectors that are at overcapacity. I cannot rule out that risk, and it would concern me if that were so, but I think a lot is changing at the margin in China. When Kate and I were there in May, we visited several banks, and we quizzed them as to what they were doing, and every one of them had a blacklist with respect to certain sectors to which they no longer intend to lend, and they were all the sectors that have been deemed to have the greatest overcapacity, and they're the obvious culprits such as steel and coal, glass and shipbuilding, and there were a few other sectors in mining and so forth. So I think there's already a recognition within China that the economy must structurally change. I think you can also see that from the fact that the Chinese authorities have shocked everyone with the extent to which they are willing to ignore the pleas for stimulus. I think the Chinese authorities are very cognizant that the economy is slowing, and yet they have not as yet done much to re-stimulate the economy. They may do so. I would not put it past them if growth slows too sharply in a way that they can't feel comfortable with. But at this moment, I think China is undergoing a lot of structural reform already. And that is, I would suggest to anyone who thinks that there's going to be a huge and sharp leg downward from here is already sort of looking at past facts and trying to extrapolate them forward. I think we're already in the middle of the correction. It may not be over yet. It may go on a while longer, but we are in the middle of it, and that's why, another reason why all of these commodity prices have been falling so sharply in recent months.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for those comments, and thank you, Kate and Paul, for your participation in this call, and we certainly appreciate everybody that's joined us on the line today. We want to continue the dialogue with you as best we can. The way to reach us is via our website and our email, contact@seafarerfunds.com. Thank you.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.